This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh here with me bright and early, 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 2nd of November. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Certainly early, yeah. Not so bright, though, but yes.
Not yet. But yeah, we're...
I was talking about my eyes.
Your eyes, always bright. Always bright. And your sparkling personality. Don't forget that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, coming up today on the show, every Thursday, we have the InvestSmart series on the morning run that's brought to you by the Securities Commission. And at 6 o'clock every Thursday morning, we kick off a Twitter poll. Now, this week, we're going to be looking at another form of investments, ETFs or exchange traded funds. And the poll we've got going on Twitter is, would you invest in ETFs? The options are, yes, I already do. Yes, if convenient. No, it's too risky. Or no, I don't know enough about ETFs. Now, you guys, which option would you pick?
Oh, okay. Well, I guess it depends. Here's the thing, because in Malaysia, according to the SC, you know, their latest data as of September 2017, there are only 8 ETFs here in Malaysia. Now, on top of that, one of the criticisms of the ETFs here is that there's a lack of liquidity, right? So it's kind of hard to say, but nevertheless, we certainly applaud the SC's efforts to really educate people more about the existence of these ETFs, and hopefully, depending on your risk profile, participate in it.
Yeah, so essentially ETF, it represents a kind of collection of different asset classes that means investors get an exposure to a whole host of different sectors and industry. So diversifying your portfolio, right? So more on this just before the 8 o'clock news. Joyce, are you going to look at ETFs as a form of investment?
To listen in and then, yes. I'll more about that after that. Well, I don't know enough about it.
Okay, well,
what a good employee. Yes, I will listen in to the BFM programming.
Well, we've got Zainal Abidin from the SC to tell us more about ETFs. That's in a couple of hours. But let's take a look at the news overnight. Since we're talking about markets, let's start with the US Federal Reserve. Just a few hours ago, the Fed held off on an interest rate hike, right?
Yes, they did. There's an expectation that they will up it, but that's perhaps later down the line in the year. So, I mean, a couple of months left,
yeah,
right?
So
yeah, maybe November.
December.
So that's the news right there. And then now all eyes will be on the Fed chair. Who will Donald Trump pick?
Trump's nominee for the Fed chair. That's going to be announced. Expectations are later tonight, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm.
Right. So according to media reports, they've already tapped Jerome Powell, according to stories in the Wall Street Journal, that there have been discussions between Donald Trump and Jerome Powell already. But again, we have to wait and see if that decision is actually, if that pick is actually true. But, you know, just to kind of give you an idea for market expectations, right, for the next Fed rate hike, we look at the Fed funds futures. Earlier this week, it was at about 83%. Now it's 87.5%. In other words, markets believe that there's an 87.5% chance that the Fed will raise interest rates come December 13th.
Okay. So strong expectations for at least one more hike before the year ends.
I mean, on top of that, the Fed just loves December, right? Like, they raised
U.S.
interest
rates.
Oh, yeah,
you're right. Yeah. Last year as well.
2 Decembers in a row.
So what, a Christmas present to everybody or what?
I don't have a present. It's a present for the dollar.
All right. Well, let's move on to other news. Let's take a look at the New York attack. Now, authorities have established that the man accused of killing 8 people in New York by driving a truck down a cycle lane was inspired by the Islamic State group. I guess the question surrounding this, as details emerge as investigations are ongoing, is the coverage and how we're treating this. So a lot has been said about the differences between the Manhattan attack and how the media calling it a terrorist attack versus what happened with Vegas and how most media coverage and even the president didn't refer to that as a terrorism attack.
Yes, that's always the case. It's really so obvious, and you can see even the kind of media coverage when it is when they label it a terrorist attack, and then they zoom in into the perpetrator, like
the
why did he do this? Where is he from? When did he come to US or whatever? You know, it's the kind of coverage that they do.
Yeah, right. And also, you know, in terms of comparing the modus operandi, you recall that in Charlottesville, James Alex Fields also used a car to ram into people. Mm. But in that instance, you know, it wasn't labeled as a terrorist attack.
It's lots of fine people,
right? Yeah, but yeah, despite the same modus operandi, that being using a vehicle to ram into people, right?
It's coming up to 6 minutes past six, and after this, we're going to be looking at why millennial workers feel guilty when requesting for vacation days. Stay tuned to The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. This is The Morning Run, and you're with me, Melissa Idris, Joyce Goh, and Tan Chung Han, as well as Al Green there with I'm Still In Love With You. It's 9 minutes past six, and we're looking at a new survey conducted by Allianz Global Assistance, which has revealed that millennial workers in the US are suffering the most from what they call vacation shaming. That's a term that's used to describe work environments where colleagues and bosses indirectly discourage employees from taking time off. So,
no shame at all. Come on. Like, it's mine, folks. All right? It's rightfully mine. So, no shame.
No qualms, at all.
Look, okay. I guess some shame might be, you know, might creep up if, let's say, I decide to take a vacation during peak periods, right? So if I'm thinking of, like, say, the auditors, you know, who have, like, these deadlines or you know, companies that have are more project-oriented, right? And then if you mistime your vacations, then, yeah, there might be some shaming involved.
All right. I'm trying to understand where this comes from, because according to this kind of vacation confidence index by Allianz, as many as 25% of millennials, or a quarter of the respondents, reported feeling nervous when requesting time off from the employers. And if you look at, say, the Gen Xers, they don't really care. Or the rest of the workers aged 55 and above, none of them have the same kind of reservations.
Do you think maybe because they are the young ones, that they're the first starting out, and then they're the juniors, so they're a bit more afraid to, hey, I want to take some time off. Maybe that's that. I mean that's
really?
Just, I don't know. But according to this index, a vacation confidence index, it revealed that 48% of millennials are not using all their paid time off each year.
Wow, that's like half of the respondents.
Yeah, right. But coming back to your point, Han, about peak period, don't take time off. What if your peak period is throughout the year, like other, like for us,
like
it's a daily, like a daily, the news flow doesn't stop, right?
Yeah.
So how like that?
No, so I think in that instance, then it's accepted, you know, that we will just take our annual leaves or annual days as and when possible, right? So I guess it's really context specific, you know, company specific. You be smart also, know when to request for your vacation.
Do you think that there's this perception that if you do ask for time off from work, that means that you're not a good worker? So like the more unpaid vacation days I have means, well, I'm hardworking. I'm more hardworking than you. Is that a kind of perception?
Look, yeah, I think there's an element of truth to that, you know, whereby, okay, at least in the media lie, I'm not saying this is true of BFM, but, you know, previous gigs, if let's say you're able to take 2-3 weeks away from the team and the team functions well without you, then that implies, well, the show is going on fine without you. So,
it's
you know,
a well functioning team.
Yeah, so perhaps it's you're dispensable.
I'm a believer that no one is indispensable uh-huh. though. So it doesn't matter. There's no one personality. You need a team to run, whether is it to put out a paper, whether it's to run a daily show at the radio or whatever it is. You need a team. There's no one person. I believe that is. Of course, the leader is important, but at the end of the day, it's a team effort, right? But when it comes to taking leave, as you asked, Melissa, I think it depends on the team culture as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The team culture, whether or not it's okay if you don't. It really boils down to the team dynamics and you know, tone from the top.
Yeah exactly. The company culture as well.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, what about in Malaysia where it's multicultural, we have many, many public holidays. What's the etiquette for vacation time then? So let's say everyone wants to go on leave at the end of the year. So half the office, tutup lah.
Well, I think that's a given, right? Because, you know, come, say, Chinese New Year, the Chinese employees will have more family commitments and whatnot. Likewise with Raya and Deepavali and Christmas and et cetera, right? So I think that should be the norm there, and that should be the bias, right? Whereby if you're observing that particular holiday, then you should be given preference.
Yeah, and we could work around that as well. You know, like how if, like for a daily show, we can do more things ahead of time, mm-hmm. or something you can plan ahead of time, then maybe do that because you're expected, I mean, people are expected to take leave at that time off, or maybe like year end, you know, when everybody, when people wind down
that
and all.
Last week of December, where nothing essentially happens.
Right.
But if you have to come to work and all your colleagues are off on holidays, sometimes, you know, breeds that resentment. Oh, man, this isn't fair.
Yeah.
Now, while broadly speaking, you know, I have zero regrets or zero remorse when it comes to applying for annual leave. But at the same time, I must concede that when it comes to, say, medical, like MC, I feel that regret, though, because I'm I wish I had taken care of myself better, you know, like this could have
unplanned.
Been avoided.
It's unplanned. And you don't, sometimes you have stuff planned for it, like you have work or whatever, and you know that you need to finish it, but you can't physically, right?
Right, and then you're letting your team down because, you know, you ate something wrong the night before or something. So,
do you know there are some companies out there that reward you for not taking any sick days? So at the end, if you don't take, say, you don't take any sick days at the end of, say, a quarter or a six-month period, they give you a cash reward or some kind of incentive.
Is our boss listening right
that's
now?
That's good. Or maybe, actually.
Which probably explains why there were a lot of, like, sniffles and colds. People with flu came to the office anyway. Anyway, it's coming up to 6:15. And after this, we're going to be looking at WhatsApp's new feature, which lets us delete messages after we've sent them. Is this a good development? We'll discuss in just a few minutes on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Just Like Heaven by The Cure. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. It's 6:20 right now, Thursday the 2nd of November. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh right here with me as we take a look at a new feature on WhatsApp. WhatsApp is adding the ability to delete and revoke messages after you've sent them. So now you're going to be able to delete any unwanted messages that you've sent up to 7 minutes after you've sent them. So what do you guys think about this development? Are you happy with it?
Yeah, I think it's good. In a way, sometimes you accidentally send the message
to the wrong person.
Sometimes, you know, you're chatting halfway and then there's a lag. Like, you think that you're, let's say I'm chatting to Melissa, I'm like chatting something and then I want to send something to Han.
Because we're talking about Han anyway.
Right? And then after that, I was like, Han. And then after that,
you accidentally send it
to Han. Oh no, I have to delete that. And then faster delete it.
So previously, WhatsApp had that delete function, but it only deleted the message on your phone.
Now it
deletes on everyone's phone. But what turns up is a message that says, this message has been deleted.
Right, exactly. And so with that notification of this message has been deleted, while on one hand, you know, it may help you save face, that may have an inverse relationship with, say, the level of suspicions in the group. You know, because, you might be able to delete that embarrassing message, but then everyone in the group is going to think, so what was the message you sent that you had to delete?
Okay.
I'll be a bit more suspicious about my, you know, the members in that WhatsApp group.
I do think this is interesting because it just shows that as we become more and more reliant on text as a way of communication, we're seeing, you know, changes or added features to it, right? So, and given how Malaysians love using WhatsApp, we're probably one of the highest WhatsApp users around the world. Mm. I know we are the highest when it comes to using WhatsApp for spreading news in the world. But so it's all these new functions and features that I recently discovered, the reply to a message. So you click right click or you press on the WhatsApp message and it comes out reply or forward or whatever.
Yeah.
You can reply specific messages even in a WhatsApp group, which is very helpful, right?
Right, because given the widespread use of WhatsApp and, you know, with so many different members of the group having simultaneous discussions. So there could be multiple threads, right? So in going back to this point about WhatsApp etiquette, please use that, what do you call it?
The reply.
Because it's one thing for, like, say, you know, a few members of the group to be going on about this one particular topic. And then, you know, somebody else might be responding to something earlier, but without using the reply button, they'll just say something random and it just throws the prior conversation completely off. You know?
Which I agree with. Yeah. I completely agree with. For me, the WhatsApp etiquette faux pas has to be the interrupting in the WhatsApp group. So we're all on WhatsApp group chats, and then, you know, we're talking about something. There's always one uncle or someone who will come halfway and then change the topic to something completely different.
Right.
Like, yeah, that's true. That's true. And then you get thrown off guard, and the conversation is everybody's. Yeah. For me, it's people screenshotting in a way. Like how you don't know what they screenshot of what you say, and then they go and forward that on WhatsApp to someone else or what.
Right. Is that bad etiquette? I mean, because WhatsApp's encrypted, right? And it goes on and on about how, you know, WhatsApp's encrypted and it's a private channel to discuss. But that doesn't, you know, take into account screenshotting. Yeah. People screenshot your conversations and forward them.
Right. This is where trust, you know, is absolutely crucial when it comes to the respective members of the group, right?
So, well, tell us if you like this new function from WhatsApp, being able to delete messages after you sent them. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Please send your thoughts, but don't delete them afterwards because then we can't see it. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got the Sundays next with Here's Where the Story Ends on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Don't You Want Me by Human League. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run 640 right now. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh right here as we take a look at the World Economic Forum's survey called Technology Tipping Points and Societal Impact. What they did essentially was speak to 800 technology executives and experts from the ICT sector. And this is what they think life will be like in 2030. So they say goodbye to your screens, because in the future, light field displays may eliminate altogether the need for headsets or display screens, because now they can project 4D images directly onto your retinas from a point of focus. So no longer your tablets or your phones.
Yeah, and also going through some of these details in the World Economic Forum survey. So, for example, over 90% of respondents think that by the year 2030, 10% of us will be wearing clothes connected to the internet. We will see the first 3D printed car in production. That's according to 84% of respondents. And, with about almost 80% of the respondents saying that 90% of the population will have regular access to the internet by 2030. Like, on one hand, while you read all these forward-looking sort of stories and surveys, right, I wonder how much of it will become reality. Because, for example, you know, you take Blade Runner, right? Blade Runner, when it first came out, you know, back in the 80s, I think, or 70s or 80s, right? And then it projected this idea as to how Los Angeles will look like by the year 2019. Well, you know, we are quite close to 2019, and I doubt LA will look like anything as portrayed in Blade Runner. Right?
I have to say, when I saw this article, I thought, oh, you know, that sounds cool because it's in the future. But when you think about it, it's not really that far away. It's essentially 2030 is
about 12 years.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I still think 1998 is a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And in the article, it states that technology tipping points expected to occur by 2025. That's even closer than we're talking about, right? And this respondents, right, 63.7% say the first city with more than 50,000 people, no traffic lights. I kind of like that.
Lights.
Yeah.
What do you mean? So how? It's because it's all driverless cars.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah.
And with all the sensors around them.
So
no,
maybe
but
no jams.
Yeah, oh, yay. That'd be a great thing.
But clearly, that's one thing Joyce is looking forward to.
No, but once again, I wonder how much of this will actually become reality. Because did you guys do this during your school days when Vision 2020 was first announced?
Yes.
And in school, we had to do this like drawing competitions. Like, oh, what do you think Malaysia will be like in 2020?
Did you have flying cars?
Yeah, exactly. All of us do flying cars. Well, guess what? No, here we are, you know, 3 years from now. About 2-3 years away from 2020, and I doubt flying cars will become the norm.
Well, ride-sharing apps have made that too.
Yeah, but we
slightly closer to flying cars.
Yeah. So who knows really what the future holds? But whether or not this is something that is based on what we have right now, what we see, you know, because when we were drawing flying cars on our papers in the 80s and 90s, thinking what Malaysia will be like in 2020, we didn't think about ride-sharing apps. We didn't think about the Alibabas and the Facebooks, right?
So if we did, we wouldn't be here talking, right? we'll be running the unicorns, right? Yeah.
For sure. One of the things that the experts, ICT experts and tech executives are saying is going to be big is gene editing. So this is CRISPR technology, if you've heard of it, not just for humans. So, you know, now, expecting parents can choose the color of their child's hair or eyes. And I'm sure there's regulation to be put in place for that because of all the ethics that comes with it.
Yeah, even with gender. I mean, there should be. If not, everyone... I mean, some parents will pick a certain gender, right?
So everyone's going to look like Brad Pitt. Is that how it works?
That's not a bad thing.
Do you want your kid to look like Brad Pitt, is it?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? All right, it's 6:45 right now. After this, we're going to be looking at the cost of controversial speakers and protesters. Are they worth the money that universities spend on them to preserve free speech? That's next with The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Aretha Franklin with Good Times There. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. Now, let's take a look at the US, as universities in the US are now spending more to have controversial speakers come to the campuses to give talks. So the recent case of the white nationalist Richard Spencer appearing at the University of Florida has sparked a declaration of a state of emergency by Florida's governor. The preparations that went into having Richard Spencer come and talk on campus had a huge price tag because the university was essentially preparing for civil disobedience, for protests and for riots and, you know, the cost of security.
Right.
What do you guys think about it? Is it worth spending that kind of money? We're talking about $500,000 in terms of security for having these speakers come on campus?
Yeah, I think that really is the question here, right? You know, is free speech worth it, right? You know, on one hand, you want to create this safe space for protesters to voice out against these controversial speakers. At the same time, you would like to think that these schools in the States have the platform for these controversial speakers, right? But then ultimately, it comes at a cost. So, I mean, for the University of Berkeley in California, they have spent over $2 million on security costs alone. And that's just for one school for 1 year, right? So you add them all up, it comes out into the millions. You would think that those millions would be better used for, say, scholarships.
Yeah, exactly. Right, it's such a high cost for just security personnel, security spending on just getting
just
a speaker to come
safe, right?
To come and speak, like, what, one-off, right, kind of thing. Mm. Now in a tech world, right, why can't they do it virtually? No, sorry, that's just a question on mine. Can they do it virtually?
It's a valid point.
It's more real time and more like, why do you need to spend so much to get him? Okay, I guess the whole physical, you know, there's the whole physical interaction. Mm. But now when all these universities are like promoting tech virtual and all that, why can't you do that?
Well, there's also the argument that even though if they host these speakers virtually, it's not just about keeping the speaker safe. It's not just the price tag of security for the speaker, but also for crowd management. Right, because sometimes crowds get rowdy and they want to protest the presence of a speaker. Like, for example, I think former Breitbart editor Milo Yiannopoulos, when he wanted to go, I think that was cancelled. There was a riot and you know, some kind of unrest there. So, is it worth, in the spirit of fostering debate and free speech, having these speakers come to an academic platform, and you know, that's just part and parcel of what it takes to have kind of free speech?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the line has been broken there somewhat. Now, I mean, okay, we're not talking about, say, President Obama visiting a campus and the security costs, right? Now those security costs are being extended to, you know, these other speakers as well, right? So you've got comments from some of these school administrators who says this is clearly not sustainable, right? Not just for the school, but also for taxpayers as well, especially given that these are federally funded schools as well. So, you know, like, I think there has to be that line right? Or that limit to free speech, right? Because ultimately, it can't just be a free-for-all. There has to be, you know, some kind of accountability, not just in terms of, you know, thoughts that are being put out there, but also when it comes to the costs that are associated with a certain school of thought. Right?
Yes.
And we are seeing that, you know, across, like, say, even Joyce, going back to what you mentioned about how maybe this would be a better discussion online. Well, guess what? Germany, you know, Facebook themselves, you know, Google, they're trying to filter out all these, be it fake news or content that's related to terrorism, etc. Right? So there has to be that line drawn somewhere.
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't know. I mean, universities historically used to be where you would come together to discuss an issue of the day. If you can't bring all these controversial figures to and have this debate, where does that, you know, where does that leave the role of public discourse? Where are, you know, what's the role of universities in terms of stimulating that?
Well, see, and that's the thing, you know, ideally you would think that these college campuses or these university settings will be a great ground or a great platform to have those discussions in a civil manner. And I think that's the key part.
Now
that's
gotten out of civility.
Right, exactly. You know, so now that is lost and it's coming at this tremendous cost. So, you know, you got to ask yourself now then, you know, it's like, well, is the free speech really worth it? You know, because if let's say you only want to protect the speaker, then the protesters, like, they want to have their say as well.
Right.
But then where do you draw that line?
I agree. Well, tell us what you think. WhatsApp number 018-789-8899. Do you think it's worth the cost of security to preserve free speech? Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. We've got a tweet here from Amir to talk about, just in reference to our earlier discussion about millennials and the feeling of guilt when applying for leave. Now, Malaysians tend to use medical leave or MCs more than annual leave. Most find MCs easier to get.
Speaking from experience there, buddy.
thanks for your tweet. We encourage you to write into us. Join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. But we've got Lenny Kravitz up next with Are You Gonna Go My Way? On BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. It's 6 minutes past 7 o'clock, Thursday, the 2nd of November. I'm Melissa Idris, and I've got with me
Tan Chung Han.
As we take a look at all the news that you'll need to know as you start your day, we'll catch you up on that, including the latest update on the attempted sale of information belonging to tens of millions of Malaysians. Also, just a few hours ago, we had the Federal Reserve hold off on an interest rate hike ahead of a leadership decision for the Fed chair, which is set to be announced by Donald Trump. Donald Trump's nominee is set to be announced later tonight. So we'll take a closer look at that. But let's come back to the news about the removal of subsidies. So according to the Health Minister, Dr. S. Subramaniam, he says that the removal of subsidies for sugar has not had the intended effect of reducing sugar consumption. He was quoted as saying, "We see there is no decrease in consumption of sugar." So now Malaysia may be considering a tax on sugar, taxing sugar, as a way to curb sugar consumption. So for more insights on this, because clearly you and I, Han, are not experts on healthy eating.
Well,
we tend to indulge a little bit in our, you know, junk food and not the best of healthy eating.
All I'm going to say is thank God we are on radio now.
But they can't see our waistline, shall we say.
Mine. You're fine. You're fine, girl.
Anyway, we spoke to dietitian Gui Chui Hong and asked her perspective on whether the removal of sugar subsidies was effective at all.
That is probably true because I think the amount of subsidy was about 80 cents per kilo of sugar. So in actual fact, it worked out to be about 0.004 cents per teaspoon of sugar. So that's hardly anything. So if you say a person takes 5 teaspoons, they only have to pay 0.02 cents more. So the impact is negligible. So I guess that's why the removal of subsidy didn't actually have a great impact. But I think that was probably one of the first steps to it because it didn't make sense to subsidize somebody from, you know, using sugar. Yeah, actually encouraging people, is it? So definitely removing subsidy is the first step to reducing the amount of sugar intake.
We also asked her how feasible would it be to impose a sugar tax here in Malaysia?
I think it should be quite feasible. It's been done in several countries. Some countries like Mexico has reported a reduction in intake of sugar by, I think, 5% the first year and then almost 10% the second year. So, I mean, it's promising. It's not completely foolproof because you may find that when you incur a tax in a country, then you might find some very resourceful citizens going to a neighbouring country to obtain sugar, you see. But in general, I think in Malaysia, we are still getting our sugar quite cheaply. So that may not be a key problem yet.
We also asked her, how much should the sugar tax be if the removal of sugar subsidies wasn't enough to burn a hole in our pockets?
I think WHO actually recommends a tax of about 20% for it to be effective. If I look at countries like the UK, they're planning to impose it starting April 2018. They're going to charge, if a product has more than 5 grams of sugar per 100 grams, then they'll be taxed 18p. And if they have more than 8 grams per 100 grams, they'll be charged 24 cents extra. So that's quite a significant amount, because if, let's say, you're buying a drink for £1, it becomes £1.40 for a 200ml can, for example. So that is a significant increase in the price of the item. So people might think twice. But I think the whole idea of doing this tax is actually to get the manufacturers to reduce the amount of sugar in their products, because by doing that, then what's available in the market will be products which have got less sugar anyway. So people are actually choosing product A, which has got less sugar, and product B, which has also got less sugar. So that should be the aim, to just reduce the amount of sugar across the board.
We asked her, what else can we do to discourage sugar consumption besides a sugar tax?
Ideally, it should be a multi-pronged thing whereby, yes, you have a tax on the sugar, you get the food manufacturers to reduce the amount of sugar in their food or drink products, and you also have a lot more health promotion activities to educate the population, because ultimately you still need to get the people to get used to the idea of consuming less sugar. You also need to get people who sell drinks and sweetened food in restaurants to get used to the idea of preparing their food or drinks with less sugar. So, for example, if you go to a mama's store, getting them to reduce the amount of condensed milk which they put inside. I know of a friend who actually tells me that he drinks his tea direct with 6 tablespoons of condensed milk, and that's quite a significant amount of sugar there, you see. So it can't just be imposing a tax and not doing anything else, because I think you need to have a big push from all directions.
That was dietitian Gu Chui Hong talking about this proposal for a sugar tax in Malaysia. What do you think, Han? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, I mean, where do we even begin, right? Because this is just such a loaded issue. I mean, look, from personal experience, you know, despite, and I'm speaking just for myself here, right? I mean, despite knowing the ill effects that can come from an overconsumption of sugar, yet I still gravitate towards those sugary drinks, right? So on one hand, you might have these policies, like, you know, these sin taxes, right, for sugar. But at the same time, if the underlying demand is still there, you know, then these kind of policies can only go so far.
Would a sugar tax, a 20% tax on sugar, would that deter you from ordering your sugary drink? Condensed milk with 6 tablespoons of
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's how this works, right? Because if you impose that, that 20%, or like in India's case, they got a 24% tax on demerit goods, or even for a flavor refined sugar in India, it's charged 18% tax, right? Now, on top of that, if let's say, you know, that could result in inflationary pressures for sure, especially when it comes to our food and when we eat away from home, right? Now, whether or not that is efficiently passed through, you know, whether or not businesses will use that as an excuse to just raise prices across the board, you know, that is another issue on its own. But when it comes to consumption, though, well, we have seen, like, for example, when it comes to tobacco, despite the hike in taxes, it did not necessarily result in a decline in consumption of tobacco, right? Instead, what it did was, at least according to tobacco industry players, it then fostered the illicit market, right? So could we see the same thing playing out in the sugar space?
I do agree with you. Yeah, I do agree with you because I do see sugar as to be a bit of an addiction, right? We're kind of addicted to having sugar in our food despite knowing that it's bad for us in excess. I think the kind of healthier approach would be the education. So again, you know, when you're talking about smoking, for instance, education does a lot more in terms of the harmful effects of smoking, does a lot more for people to quit smoking as opposed to, say, you know, just increasing the prices of cigarettes every time the tax, you know, you impose a tax on it. But for me, healthy foods in Malaysia are so expensive. Right. Some of them are so expensive. I mean, you could go to the wet market and get cheaper foods prepared for yourself. But have you ever bought a salad in the city? I mean, that's $20 right there. Mm-hmm. Tell me that that's not expensive, because there are unhealthier, cheaper options right out there.
And on one hand, when you go to a restaurant, they'll charge you 3, 4, 5 ringgit for a bottle of mineral water, but then you can pay the same price and have bottomless soda, right? Now, how does that work out?
Yeah, so the tax should come with some kind of incentive for healthier foods.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. At the same time, when it comes to, say, education, right? I mean, despite all these gory pictures being plastered on these cigarette boxes, has it really gone, I mean, how far has it gone to deter people from smoking? I would argue not much. So likewise with sugar, if, like I said earlier, if that underlying demand is still there, and let's face it, like you said, it's tremendously addictive, you know, you tax all you want, you know, and educate all you want, but really, you know, at the end of the day, if you want sugar, you want sugar.
For sure.
That's so profound.
It's 7:15 right now. We're going to be back with a look at the front pages of today's papers. Stay tuned to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.